So last time we were talking about this notion of humanism, and I gave the definition of humanism as a doctrine that asserts the dignity or worth of mankind and mankind's capacity for self-realization through reason. So how can we respect people's personal dignity? How can we make physical environments that really emphasize that dignity? And also that we really use the physical environment as a mechanism for helping people accomplish their goals, do the things they want to do with their lives, achieve a kind of self-realization. So last time we were looking at that notion at a smaller scale. How do you actually design anything from a door handle to a desk or a piece of furniture, a chair? How do these things find a way to respect the human physiognomy, human needs, human comfort? How do those get embedded in that design? And then at a slightly larger scale than that, at individual buildings, how does that become an inspiration for architecture? So today we're going to take that same notion of humanism, but we're going to be looking at it at a much larger scale, at the scale of communities and neighborhoods and even cities. How do we use that same idea of self-realization, helping people accomplish what they want to accomplish through the larger physical environment? And we're going to begin the discussion today by talking a little bit about Austin. Austin's an interesting city these days, and I'm constantly blown away as I travel other places in the United States, the degree to which there's a notion that Austin is doing something interesting. And I've lived here forever, and I kind of take it for granted that, well, of course, wouldn't any city want to make themselves better, make themselves a more humanistic city? But somehow that isn't pervasive in a lot of cities. And there is something, I think, in just real estate markets in the United States that produce more freeways, more sprawl, more suburbs, more shopping centers, more office park, maybe environments that are not, that people have some complaints about what it's like to live there. And I do think that Austin has, over the past maybe 20, 25 years, said we want to make a more interesting, I mean, even the Keep Austin Weird thing. Maybe there's another pattern of living or working or that could be nurturing. And maybe that sort of normal Sunbelt city with just lots more sprawl and suburbs and cul-de-sac subdivisions and shopping malls. And maybe that's not what we really want to do in Austin. So there has been a real overt effort over the past 20 or 30 years to, can we reshape our city in a more humanistic way? And it's not like by any means total success in my book. I mean, we still got a ton of sprawl. We still got terrible traffic problems. We still got lots of things that are screwed up and going wrong, and people having, you know, really sort of mind-numbing commutes and extremely inconvenient, lifestyle because they're trying to get their kids to the soccer game. They're trying to get home from work. They're trying to shop. They're trying to get dinner. And all these things are just frustrating to try to get to all these places and get them all assembled, and it makes for a kind of miserable life. So that's still there, but there are these efforts to try to do something different. Now, there was, at the beginning of this period, a notion that, well, the way you stay a more interesting or humanistic city is to just not grow, just stay small, because smaller is more nurturing, more personal, more greater chance for self-realization. And there were people who thought, I like the way it is. I don't want things to change. So let's just stop. I think that's a very backward way of thinking about it. And at the time, it was a big controversy. There was a real anti-growth movement in Austin. Luckily, I think those people got overruled. And there was a notion that, no, you can actually grow, and maybe in the process of growing, you can make things better, not grow and make it worse, but grow and make it better. But you have to get some handle on what is the right way to grow. So there's been a lot of real overt efforts to grow in a more interesting way. So there are successes, there are failures in that regard, but there are successes too. There's an interesting book by Richard Florida, who's an economist, called The Rise of the Creative Class, and he's looking at these cities that creative people want to go to and that companies want to go to, companies like Apple or Google or Facebook or, you know, newer companies that are trying to attract interesting employees, employees that are thinkers and are creative. And he makes the argument that some cities make interesting environments and it attracts those people. And then other cities, when it's not a good quality of life, those people just won't go there. And those companies won't go there. And as a result, their economic situation is sad. And they don't have much economic vitality. So he actually looks at dozens of cities in the United States, even some, he does an assessment abroad. What are the cities that are places where people feel like I can achieve self-realization? This is a place I can go and I can live and I can have a great life and I can excel professionally and I can have a good live-work balance and I can have a family and, you know, all those things can work for me. What are the cities where that could work? And what are the cities where that's really hard? And he says that's a big economic difference for those cities. And in the first edition of his book, he ranked all these cities in the United States, and Austin was the second highest ranked city in terms of having that kind of possibility for self-realization, for making a place where people could feel like they could do the things they want to do. And in the second edition of that book, Austin was number one, beat out San Francisco, which is pretty amazing. So that's one kind of metric of success. I also, on a more local or personal level, I've always thought that Seattle was a wonderful city in this regard, really great humanistic city. And I've spent a lot of time in Seattle, have a lot of friends in Seattle. Several months ago, one of my best friends in Seattle, who's an architect and his wife is a urban design person, they're very, very involved in Seattle politics and urban issues. And they were down in Austin visiting. They were here for 3 or 4 days, and I had dinner with them the last night they were in town. And we were at a restaurant on 2nd Street. And so Mark is saying, "Whoa, Larry, I love your city. Austin is so great. There's just so many things we could learn from Austin in Seattle, and we should be doing the kinds of things you're doing here." And I'm like, holy moly. I thought all these years I was learning from Seattle. I thought Seattle had it, and we were the wannabe. But now Austin's kind of moved into this position of being seen as a leader, as a city that's kind of getting some of these things right. And again, I want to emphasize, we're also getting a lot of things wrong. We got a long way to go. But there are some interesting movements in this direction in Austin. Now, I'm going to make the argument today that there are 8 key factors in making a city a truly humanistic city, a city where people can have self-realization, that we can logically, reasonably think through how do we organize the city so that people can achieve what they want to achieve. They can have a life that supports their career, that supports their family, that supports their social life, that makes it easy to have friendship formation. All of these things can be achieved. And as I go through these 8, I'm going to use Austin as an example and talk about things that we've done in Austin to try to achieve that. Very intentional things we've done to try to achieve each of these 8 characteristics. So the first characteristic is convenience. You cannot have a humanistic city without having convenience. It cannot be frustrating just to do the kind of things you need to do and needs to be efficient, needs to be convenient. So for example, if you are cooking dinner and you realize, oh, I screwed up, I didn't get, you know, lettuce, and I meant for us to have a salad, I need to go to the grocery store and get some lettuce. If it's a 20-minute drive to the grocery store, that is super inconvenient. If any time you just make a mistake and forget something, it's like 20 or 30 minutes to go get that thing. That's inconvenient. If, in fact, there's a place where you can just bop out, walk two blocks, you know, pick up that head of lettuce and head back and be back in 5 minutes, that's convenient. That's great. So convenience means that we've located the things that need to be near each other and available in a way that they are available to people. And that means that your workplace is not so far from the place you live that you have this inconvenient commute you have to do. It means that your kid's school is not so far from your home that it's inconvenient to deliver them to school or pick them up from school or get them on the bus or whatever needs to be done. It means that just all of the everyday things you need to do, going to church, going to shopping, taking your kids to activities, all those things are local and available and convenient, as opposed to having to make these huge, long drives across the city to do that. Now, because convenience is at a slightly smaller scale, too, in that it means that it's actually pretty easy to, if you're looking for a bookstore, there's a bookstore there. If you're looking for a movie theater, there's a movie theater nearby. And even at a much smaller scale, if I'm walking down the street and I want to, you know, take the bus to go somewhere, is there a bench for me to sit on? Is there shade so I'm not out in the sun? Are these things convenient? And it also means convenience for people who have maybe some impairment. So for mobility impaired people, is it easy for them to get from point A to point B without big flights of stairs or very difficult ways to negotiate that? People with baby carriages, is it easy for them to get around the city without having to take the baby out, unfold the baby carriage, walk up the steps, fold the baby carriage out, put the kid back in? Is there just a ramp so I can do that and it's convenient? All of this is super important. Convenience is a huge thing. So in Austin, I mean, I have lived here a long time, and at the beginning of the time, I moved from Boston to live in Austin, and at first I was a little daunted by the inconvenience of life here because I couldn't find a neighborhood where all those things were close, like the neighborhood I'd been in Boston. But now that is totally remedied. In the downtown area, we've created this mixed-use environment. And one of the reasons why it's very popular and the prices shot up because people want to live there, but it's super convenient. So I live in a high-rise building downtown, and within two blocks of my house, I can there are 14 different restaurants I can go to, everything from Frank and Angie's for pizza or Hut's for a burger or to five-star restaurants. They're just super convenient. Whole Foods Mothership is in the next block over. Super convenient. It's a bookstore, Book People, just a block away. It's a movie theater, Violet Crown, four blocks away. My office, my architecture office, is four blocks away. It's maybe a 20, 25-minute walk to the campus. It's just everything's super convenient. This was not a possibility 20, 25 years ago, but now because of the mixed use quality of the center city these days, and there are also mixed use environments in places like the Domain and other peripheral parts of the city, but these mixed use environments have made it more convenient for people to access the things they need, living, working, shopping, recreation, all in a very compact area. So the first thing is convenience. The second thing is accommodation of activities. Most of us as human beings, we want to be able to get together and do things, not be bored, not feel like there's no action happening. And sometimes that's just informal activities like you know, going to a park and walking your dog or throwing a frisbee or just sitting and watching people. I mean, those informal activities. And sometimes it's more structured things like concerts or art exhibits or sports events or, you know, kinds of things that are just some action, something happening, things to do. We want activity in our environment. And so sometimes cities nurture that kind of activity. And sometimes, honestly, cities are just, it's just boring. Or that neighborhood, it's just nothing ever happens there. Now, this is something Austin's done a freaking amazing job at, of just making a city where lots of cool things happen. So especially this time of year, downtown, oh my God, let's see. There were 3 weeks in a row where we had South by Southwest. So first you have South by Southwest EDU, then you have South by Southwest Interactive, then you have South by Southwest Film, and then you have South by Southwest Music. So there's all these interesting small events, big events, new people coming in, just lots of activity going on. And then, you know, that all kind of terminated a couple of weeks ago. Then this past weekend, there was a huge fun run of some sort on the campus on Saturday, and that big event. And then there was the Capital 10,000 on Sunday, and that big event. And, you know, just pretty much all the time in Austin, there are constantly activities and festivals and music and theater and art exhibits and just lots of that going on in the city. And that makes it an interesting, lively, provocative place where people can have more self-realization. They've got options for things to do that are stimulating and interesting. So the second thing is accommodation of activity. The third thing is range of people accommodated. Range of people accommodated. So I think a city or a neighborhood is the most humanistic if there is a good mixture of people. So there are old people and young people. There are rich people and poor people. They're gregarious, kind of wild and crazy people. They're quiet and introspective people. That there really is something for everyone. And part of the reason why I think this is important is that if you're in a more homogenous environment, one where everyone's pretty much the same, then it's very easy to feel like you're the odd person out. You're ostracized in some way. You don't fit. So I can remember a couple of semesters ago, one of the students in this class, she's a sorority girl, and she invited me to speak at her sorority's, I don't know, honors dinner or something like that. And it was going to be a pretty easy speaking gig. Just wanted me to talk about things that were easy to talk about, so that was great. And so I show up at this sorority house, and I didn't really know exactly what the event was, but it turned out it's like, I don't know, 200 people there. It's not only sorority girls, it's a lot of alumni, and they're honoring their people who have been scholars, have done well with their GPA. But here's an event where there's like 200 people in the room, and I'm the only guy. It is 100% women except me. You could cut the estrogen with a knife. It was so thick in the air. And I wasn't aware of how it would make me feel. But honestly, in the room, I felt extremely uncomfortable. And dude, it's not that I'm not comfortable around women. I'm totally comfortable around women. But when I'm the only guy and everybody else is, and you know, there is this girl thing where when they greet each other, there's this little squeal like, you know, and there's all these, you know, there's women my age and there's all these alumni. And I'm like, whoa, I don't even know how to do that. It's just, when we get in homogenous groups, we have attitudes and activities that feel good in that homogenous group. But then if you're not one of those, you feel odd. You feel uncomfortable. And this can happen in a city. If you're in a neighborhood and everyone's African American and I'm the only white guy, I feel a little uncomfortable. If everybody's white and I'm the only African-American, I feel a little uncomfortable. If I'm in a group and everybody's 18 years old and I'm older, I feel a little uncomfortable. All of these are diversity issues that I think in the very most humanistic environment, we have a range of people that are accommodated there. They're little kids, they're old people, they're middle-aged people. There are people who have money and there are people who don't have money. There are people of different ethnicities. There are people of different genders. And then we can all feel comfortable in those environments. We realize all of us fit because there's no sort of rules or club that's operating here. So that actually has been a difficult thing for Austin to deal with. We have historically had very segregated neighborhoods. Not a good thing. East Austin was minority neighborhoods. You know, the southern part sort of Hispanic neighborhood, and the middle part was African American neighborhood. West Austin was all lily white. That was not very good. We've gotten a little better ethnic mix, I think, in Austin, but also the sort of rich poor split. Austin's been sort of the Tony side of town, and you know, especially southeast and northeast had been the poorer sides of town. We had these student ghettos in Austin, the whole Riverside Drive area, West Campus or Far West Boulevard. There were these, you know, those are student areas, and almost like it's redlined. And you know, if you're 35 years old and you're a young professional, you're looking for an apartment, you wouldn't go in West Campus because that's for students. And likewise, honestly, there were plenty of neighborhoods where maybe four frat boys wanted to, you know, get a house together and have nice parties and, you know, be really cool. And so they find some cool house for rent in Clarksville or Pemberton or someplace like that. And I'll tell you, they would not be welcome in that neighborhood. That's a family neighborhood. What are these college kids doing in here? They play their music too loud. They stay up too late. They have parties that make a lot of noise and take up all the parking on the street. And yeah, we have had these segregated neighborhoods. We're working, I think, to change that. But even this has been a bit of an issue with downtown, where can we get affordable housing in downtown so that it's not just rich people who live downtown? And we've done a couple of buildings in my office where there is a set aside for 15% of the building is affordable housing. So it's in a desirable area. You know, the rents are pretty expensive, but there also are some units that are for people who don't have a lot of money. And that is to get this kind of range of people accommodated. And that's a very overt political issue in Austin. How do we get affordable housing in various neighborhoods that might otherwise turn into ghettos of rich people? So that's a third issue, range of people accommodated. The fourth issue is sense of human presence. Are there things in the environment that remind us that people have their lives invested here? And this could be a whole variety of things. So for example, it's nice to have some historic buildings, even in a relatively new part of town or where there are new buildings. But the historic buildings remind us that there has been some human presence here over a long period of time. And we can see that longevity. Somehow everything being new doesn't give that richness of human presence over a period of time. So historic buildings, that's a good thing. Sometimes also it's as simple as you know, a beautifully tended flower bed in front of a park or something that, you know, obviously somebody's taking care to plant those beautiful flowers. I'm always blown away around the Littlefield Fountain. They're constantly sort of new flowers, and that's always, I don't know, just enriching, I think, to have that sense that somebody's caring and making this beautiful and a sense of human presence there. It can even be things that maybe aren't so beautiful, maybe even a little tacky. If you go around on campus and you see one of those little kiosks that has a bunch of posters for telling you where some speaking event is or where some music performance is or whatever, That's a sign of human presence. That's someone trying to communicate with you, tell you about events or happenings or things that are going on, and that's a sign of human presence. Anything that is a kind of way of tapping into somebody else's investment of time or money is a sign of human presence. So it can be historic buildings, it can be gardening and plants and flowers, and it can be posters and communications, any of those signs of human presence. And this is something that's overt all over Austin. There's plenty of that. And in particular in downtown, there has been this real effort to save the older buildings, and things like the Bremond Block or the Schneider Store, or and those are really enriching to that environment down there. You want to have that sense of a past, and certainly the Capitol Building and some of the historic buildings on Congress Avenue, on 6th Street, these are a huge enrichment to make a more humanistic downtown area in Austin. The fifth thing is a personal or human scale. There is something in us that wants to have things to our scale somewhat. So if an environment is all just big, high-rise buildings, we feel maybe a little diminished in an environment like that. And in Austin, this has been a very overt thing. There are a number of the streets in downtown where you can only build 4 or 5 stories, and then you have to step back, and then you can build a taller building. But the tall building can't be right at the street face, because we want a scale of the street that's more a human scale, maybe 4 or 5 stories and not 40 stories right on the street. So this is a way of incorporating a human scale. The fifth characteristic of a humanistic city is a variety of visual experience concurrent with some level of harmony. A variety of visual experience concurrent with some level of harmony. So we really don't want things to all look the same, like an army barracks environment. Yet we do want some kind of relationship between things. This is a tightrope you walk, a fine balance between making things too homogeneous or making things so chaotic that they don't seem to have a coherence to them. And I think that's, again, something that has been overtly dealt with in downtown Austin. They're actually, I love Vancouver. That's another really great city that I think has made wonderful strides. But they have a kind of uniformity of this certain kind of multifamily housing tower. And there's just like blocks and blocks and blocks and blocks of it. And it gets a little too uniform. They call them pencil towers. They're little skinny residential towers. And maybe a little too much of that. We got a few of those in Austin, but we don't have all those in Austin. I think that's a good thing. One of the things we have in Austin is these Capitol View corridors, areas where you can't build tall buildings because they would block the view of the Capitol building. And that means that we're never going to have in downtown Austin just that uniformity of skyline. We're always going to have these tunnels of open space that run through the city. And that creates that variety of visual experience, and yet with some degree of harmony. The seventh characteristic is a freedom from intrusion or distraction. In the urban environment, we want to be able to do what we do without being distracted. And the two big intrusions that we usually are working against are intrusions from traffic or automobiles of some sort, and the other is intrusion from weather. So in our case in Austin, it's important to try to think of how can we calm the traffic so that we're not constantly feeling like we are being hassled by the traffic. And sometimes that's traffic noise, or sometimes that's pollution that just makes that disruptive. If you're walking down the street and you're trying to have a conversation with someone and the big old bus comes up and big loud thing and then belches out a bunch of diesel pollution, that's distracting, that's intrusive. We should not have that, and that happen some places in Austin. Also, the weather can be intrusive or distracting here. It can be so damn hot that it's just not pleasant to be in the city. But if we provide shade, that can help that a lot. If we, you know, when it's raining like crazy, sometimes that deters you from doing what you want to do. But if there are arcades or covered areas that allow you to move through the city without having to worry about the rain, that's freedom from intrusion or distraction. So it's things about traffic, it's things about weather, just being free of those distractions. And then the eighth and final characteristic is periodic natural relief. Again, there's just something in human beings that wants to connect with nature. And in a city, we need, or in a neighborhood, we need periodic natural relief. Trees, lawns, shrubs, flowers, those things that connect us back to nature. So we're going to be looking today at a series of neighborhoods and thinking about how they apply these various characteristics. And I want you to think for yourself, you know, in 10 years or after you graduate from school, how do you make a decision about where I want to live? Whether it's a city you're deciding you want to live in, whether it's a neighborhood within a city you're deciding where you want to live. I think actually these factors are important, and I'm just asking you to consider those and see if this might be important to you. So the first environment we're going to look at is a neighborhood of about 350 students. And this is at University of California, Santa Cruz. University of California, Santa Cruz was founded in the 1960s. It was a very unusual campus. It's located on 2,000 acres of land that is absolutely stunningly beautiful landscape. It's redwood forest and meadows and deep ravines and then right on the Pacific Ocean. So it's spectacularly beautiful landscape. And then they built this start-from-scratch campus beginning in the 1960s. And they built it in some ways as a rebellion against some other campuses that at the time were considered not very humanistic. At the time, in the 1960s, there were virtual riots in Berkeley over some of the campus environment there, and particularly the housing there. They built a lot of just high-rise, double-loaded corridor kind of dorms, just packed those students in. This was a kind of mania in the 1960s. UT was building Jester at that moment. Berkeley built these big, big dorms at the time. And there was a lot of rejection of those environments. So in some ways, Santa Cruz was a counterbalance of that. And instead of having a big dorm for 3,000 people, instead they said, well, we want to break the university into these colleges. And they now have 10 colleges at University of California, Santa Cruz. I think Kresge College was the seventh of those to be built. And the idea was to have a smaller group of students and to have in there some faculty attached to that as well and some administrators. And this idea of a live-work environment. So there were this little library in here. There's some classrooms. There are social activities, all to make a kind of smaller-scale community in Kresge College. And it's built around this kind of street or little village. It winds through the redwood forest, and the buildings are skipping and dodging the locations of those big, beautiful trees, so that there is a real kind of meandering quality to this environment. At one end of it is what they call the town hall, and that's where there are some recreation spaces, and there used to be a dining hall there. And then down here is what they call the Piazzetta, which is a little more public plaza, and that's where the academic and administrative functions are. So there are more classrooms and things like that. in the middle at the elbow here, there are a few academic buildings there, a little library, study areas. And then along the side of this, there are the residential buildings. So it's a kind of mixed-use environment along this meandering street, integrated into the redwood forest in Santa Cruz. On the right, that's the town hall area where there's a kind of focus of activities up there. On the other end, here's the Piazzetta, which is a focus of activities down at the other end. They were looking even at like shopping malls where you'd have an anchor store at one end and an anchor store at the other end, and people would walk in between. And it's kind of an anchor activity at both ends, and then these places to meander between the two. And along the sides are all the housing. Now, one of the things there is certainly very big emphasis on convenience. Now you don't have to walk all the way across campus to your classes. You kind of roll out of bed and classes are right there integrated with your residential environment. Sometimes you need to go to the big mother library, but generally there's a little, branch library out here that's right there in your residential environment. There's certainly a place to study and study carols and online access and all that, really convenient. You don't have to go to a big dining hall with, 3,000 people eating there. Instead, there's little cafe, local places to eat in your environment. And the notion is that it's very, very convenient. Another characteristic of the place is that it's got that human scale. Both the scale of the little village here in the neighborhood, and also then within it, the scale of individual buildings, always seeming kind of intimate and like a little village or town. Combination of a lot of different kinds of activities. There are little forums where events can take place, and then there are the more private areas and little private stoops. And there also are these signs of human presence. Sometimes it's a kind of celebration of, that's kind of a podium for rallies or gatherings that would be out here. And it's got a little super graphic artwork there that shows a sign of human presence. But the signs of human presence can be as simple as like bicycles or people's stuff on their balcony or it's Halloween when I was there, somebody's jack-o'-lantern out there, other kinds of super graphics or art that are displayed, all of these little signs of human presence. Some of these photographs were taken back in the 70s. Some of these photographs I took in the maybe 5 years ago. These things have changed over time. They're big murals that the students have painted in Kresge. And that's, again, a kind of sign of human presence. That large scale and small scale, kind of intimacy, but then also a kind of, neighborhood grandeur. There is the freedom from intrusion or distraction. All the parking's kind of out here. You go through this gateway, and then it's all pedestrian through here. And sometimes there are arcades along the side so that you can get out of the rain. It rains a fair amount in the redwood forest in California. And so there's this constant awareness of being apart from that intrusion or distraction. And then there is this periodic natural relief. You're in the middle of the redwood forest. On the back sides of the buildings, they're actually painted the color of the forest so that the minute you kind of walk from the street out into between the buildings and into the forest, then it's like you're in a primeval forest. It's very dense redwoods. And the buildings kind of demure to the redwood trees and are the same color so that they're not very present. And you get immediately sort of into a forest environment just steps away from that more urban and lively and community street. So this is for a community of 350 students, 5 or 6 faculty members are assigned here. There is a faculty residence that's here, so some of the faculty live there. It's a village that is built on these ideas of humanism and self-realization. At a larger scale, this is a community for actually 10,000 people, a much larger community. This is a community called Biker in Newcastle upon Tyne. This is an industrial city in the northern part of England. This is what biker neighborhood looked like at the beginning of this project in the 1960s. It was an old neighborhood, a working class neighborhood. It was actually owned by the state. It was a public housing neighborhood. And it had been built for industrial workers back in the 18th century. And they were just little kind of townhouses, tiny little brick houses, where on the bottom you'd just have your kitchen and living room, and then upstairs you'd have a couple of bedrooms. And originally the buildings were built with no bathrooms, so they just had outhouses. And then when they came back later, they added the bathrooms on the back of the house. That meant that now, where there were windows on the back of the house, now there were no windows on the back of the house. So the interiors of these spaces were extremely small, extremely dark. There were just street after street after street of identical little worker houses like this. And they were all in very bad condition, and it was a terrible, terrible neighborhood. So the British government, because they owned it, they said, okay, we're going to redevelop Biker. And they were looking for an architect to do this. And there was this very enlightened architect, a guy named Ralph Erskine, who was a Brit by birth, but he was just getting to be an adult when World War I came along, and he was a big pacifist, and he was anti-war, so he declared himself a pacifist and left England and went to Sweden, which was a neutral country in World War II, and lived in Sweden, became an expatriate. And then after World War II, he just stayed in Sweden. And he had made his whole career as an architect in Sweden doing generally affordable housing for more disadvantaged populations. And he did these beautiful, beautiful housing environments, built very inexpensively, but beautiful housing environments in Sweden. So when they were starting to find an architect for Biker, they said, you know, here's this guy. He's a Brit, but he's been doing this beautiful, sensitive, low-income housing, and this was going to be a low-income neighborhood. Maybe we could get him to work in Biker. So they bring Ralph Erskine in, and this is a huge project. We're going to redevelop this for 10,000 people, and the idea was to scrape away all that nasty neighborhood and then completely rebuild it and make it much more humanistic and much more amenable to the people who would live there. So Ralph Erskine talks to him, looks at the whole situation, and he says, no, I don't think I'm interested in doing this project. And they're like, dude, this is like a really plum job. This is a real opportunity. You're into low-income housing. This is a huge low-income housing project. Why would you not want to do this? And he said, well, the way you're approaching this is actually going to destroy that neighborhood. Even though the housing is terrible there, there are at least people who have social fabric that's very positive for them. So this was one of those neighborhoods that had intergenerational, you know, grandparents lived there, the parents lived there, the kids lived there, you know, Aunt Maud and Uncle Harry and the cousins. And so there were all these relationships in the neighborhood. They had churches where they were, you know, committed to. We loved our friends and neighbors that go to our local church. And there were schools, and it was a community. There were some wretched things about it, but it had a sense of community. And Ralph Erskine said, if you go in there and bulldoze that and relocate all those people to other housing estates all over Newcastle, and then you build a whole new one, and then you'll never reestablish that social fabric, all those relationships. Some of the people are going to stay where they got moved away, and some people will move back, and some new. Anyway, it'll just not have the richness of human relationships that neighborhood has now. So they said, well, yeah, I mean, I get that, but what are we supposed to do? I mean, how could, it's inevitable. And he said, no, it's not inevitable. The way I would suggest you do this is you take one of these blocks, so there maybe were 40 blocks in the old Biker. You find the one block that has the most vacancies, that is in the worst condition, that it's most units are boarded up. Take that block and say, we're going to start here. take the few people that still live in that block and move them over across the street to a vacancy in a neighboring block. And then tear down just that one block and replace it with new housing. And when you do that, tell the people in the block, the next block you're going to redevelop, say, okay, you're going to be moving into this block. So talk to them about what do you want, what do you need, what kind of housing would you like to have, what's important to you, and design that with them in mind, and then move them into that block when it's finished. That then allows you to tear down their block, and then you do the same thing, just like dominoes, all the way across the neighborhood. And it's going to take 15 years. You're not going to redo this whole thing in 3 years. It's going to take 15 years, but in the end, everyone would have stayed in the neighborhood the entire time. The churches will keep their congregations. The social clubs will keep their members. Grandma, grandpa, you know, grandkids can still live in the same neighborhood continuously through the whole time. And in the end, you'll have a neighborhood that still has those social ties. So they listened to Ralph Erskine and they said, okay, that's what we're going to do. And it took them 15 years to rebuild Biker. But in the end, they kept those social ties. So I visited Biker when it was maybe halfway through the process. And I was there on a really cold, wintry day. And I was going around taking my photographs. And then, because it was so freaking cold, I kept sort of ducking into elevator lobbies or places where I could to get warm for a little while and go back out. So I'm going around photographing, and I duck in one of these little elevator lobbies, and there's a little old lady at the elevator, and she keeps eyeballing me. And she's just standing there, and she's looking at me over and over again, and I'm thinking, this woman thinks I'm going to rob her or something. I'm like a bad guy. So I went up to her and said, you know, I'm an architect from the United States. I'm just looking around here and, you know, don't mean to be intrusive. And she said, oh, you're an architect. Oh, that's interesting. So I've been standing here. I pressed the elevator button and the elevator won't come. Could you fix that? Now, you know, that's not normally what I think of architects doing, but these architects had embedded themselves in that community to the point that people thought that's what architects do. Architects help you out with the physical environment. They had, in fact, moved their offices into an old funeral parlor that was abandoned, and they set up shop in the middle of the community, and they would post their drawings at the end of the day on the glass front of this funeral parlor, and people could walk by, and then they were having lots of meetings with them and asking the people who'd be moving into this piece they were working on at the time, you know, what do you want, what do you think? And so they had really engaged this community to the point that people thought that's what architects do. They help you out making the physical environment work for you. So that was her full expectation. So I'm standing there by the elevator. I kind of push the button. I kick the door a little bit, and the freaking elevator comes. And she's completely satisfied. Okay, that's what architects do. They help you out. They make things work. But it was a really, I think, it's a wonderful thing what they did to really encourage people to. And when the buildings were new and people would move in, if somebody had a leak in their faucet, they called up the architects, and the architects instead of saying, God damn it, you don't call me. Call the building manager, for God's sake. I mean, I'm not supposed to fix your leak. Instead, they would say, well, let me call the building manager. I'll see if I can get that fixed for you. They took responsibility for the real working and positive functioning of this new neighborhood. It was a big investment over a long period of time. Okay, how did this play out in Biker? So this is a neighborhood with lots of signs of human presence. This was an old bathhouse that was in the neighborhood, and they preserved that bathhouse. The bathhouse was a real community center kind of place. And in the old Biker, when they didn't have bathrooms and they couldn't take a bath in their home, you went to the bathhouse, and that's how you, you know, had your hygiene. But later on, that became more like a social club in the neighborhood, and they institutionalized that and restored it and built it into what's called the biker wall, this continuous wall, and made it a part of the neighborhood. That's signs of human presence. Another kind of sign of human presence, just this is a little walkway that gives access to some apartments along here. And this is just so beautifully designed. This is classic Ralph Erskine, simple, inexpensive, but full of amenity kind of design. So I was walking along here. There's a little old lady, and there's a lot of little old ladies in Biker. But there was a little old lady that was sitting right on that bench right there. And just kind of, it was a cold day, damn it, but she's out there sitting on her bench. And so I start talking to her, and I ask her if I could take a picture of her sitting on the bench. And she says, oh, no, I haven't got my hair done. I've got my makeup on. No pictures. So I didn't get a picture of her. But so she was explaining to me this little bench and the little flower box. So the flower box is hers, so she can grow little posies, and that's a sign of human presence. She's, you know, it's wintertime now. She didn't have any flowers, but in the spring she'll have flowers, and it's her little expression of her presence there. The other thing is, whether she's there or not, that little bench lets you know that somebody lives here. They park themselves out here sometimes. That bench is also really great, she said, for when I come home and I've got my hands full of groceries and I got my purse and I'm trying to dig for my keys in my purse. I got to put my groceries down, and instead of having to stoop down and put them on the ground, there's this nice little bench. I can stick my groceries there, then I can fumble for my keys, open the door, get the groceries, take them in. Perfect convenience, signs of human presence, just really, really sensitive design. And in a way, she's got a little mini front porch here, separated from her neighbor, with a little bit of garden, a place to sit, and that convenience when you're opening the door. Beautiful humanistic design. Convenience is a big thing all the way through the neighborhood. There are these little convenience stores, you know, 5-minute walk from anybody, there's going to be a little grocery store. And it's just like convenience stores here. It's not, you know, you can't get a gourmet meal here, but you can get the rudiments, milk, bread, you know, toilet paper, those kinds of things. And within a 5-minute walk from anywhere, there's always a little corner store. There also are constantly little playgrounds, places where, you know, if you've got kids, it's always 5 minutes away. There's a place to take the kids and let them blow off a little steam, have a little play area there. There's also a wonderful thing here where the kids are playing right there, and they've got a little table here which is for, and has a chessboard on the top of it. And this is where the old guys hang out and play chess, and this is where the kids play. And this is where the families live that have the kids that play right there. But, you know, maybe mom or dad could, you know, park their 5-year-old out here and they're playing around, and maybe grandpa, not their grandpa, but somebody's grandpa is over here playing chess. And they, could you look out for the kids for a minute? Well, yeah, I'll be glad to. So there is that kind of neighborly just convenience that happens there when there's a mix of people involved, a range of people accommodated, and that that easy neighborliness that happens there. This range of people accommodated is built into the unit types. This is a huge part of what architecture does. If you make all 3-bedroom, 2-bath houses in a neighborhood, then you're going to attract a certain kind of person. If you make some houses that have 5 bedrooms and some houses that have 1 bedroom, then you're going to attract a range of people in there. And that's exactly what Biker does. In this larger building, the lower floor is townhouses. So you go in and it's a 2-story house, and that's probably 3 or 4 bedrooms. This is for families to live at the lower part. They have their little garden and, you know, family housing. Then up above, there's this interesting skip-stop elevator scheme where the elevator only stops at that floor. And then you have units that you enter there and go down one floor to here, or you enter and you go up one floor to here. And those tend to be smaller units, and that's maybe unmarried people, 30-somethings, 20-somethings. It might be a couple with no kids. It might be a retired couple. So a different kind of person that lives there, but they all live in the same building, in the same community. You have that range of people accommodated. There's always a variety of visual experience I mean, all of this is done by the same architects, but they're really working to make different buildings look completely different ways. And yet there is a kind of harmony within it. It's definitely not cookie cutter. It's not like the old Bikor where every block looked the same. There's a wide range of different housing types and sizes of buildings, and they all look very different from each other, and yet there is a harmony that's there. There is always the accommodation of, like, move-in, move-out vans and vehicles, service vehicles, but generally it's a pedestrian environment. And every, you know, so that is a place where a fire truck could go in if there were a fire in the neighborhood, but mostly it's a pedestrian path. And you have that freedom from intrusion and distraction. Mostly you're able to interact with people in that environment without worrying about traffic. Letting your kids go out and play in the playground without worrying about them getting hit by a car. And then there is a huge freeway on one side of this neighborhood, and the building kind of turns up back to that, and that's what they call the Bikor wall there, and all of those units have just their kitchens and bathrooms on that side of the building, and then all of their bedrooms and living rooms face the other direction, face south, which is the better solar orientation, looks down the hill to the river at the other side, but turns its back on that freeway with its noise and its intrusiveness. I'm sorry, but I was there in December, so all my photographs are of the wintertime, but there is periodic natural relief even in the wintertime. These little gardens that people have outside their townhouses, somebody was managing to have their roses bloom in December, but the Brits are real gardeners, and so all over in Bikor there's this periodic natural relief of parks and gardens that infiltrate the place. So I want to emphasize again, I mean, in the case of Kresge, that is a very, very low budget job. That was an inexpensive set of buildings. This one at Bikor, super, super inexpensive. They don't have much money they're dealing with, but they are putting a high priority on convenience, on signs of human presence, on human scale, on variety of visual experience, on freedom from intrusion and distraction, on periodic natural relief, all of those things to make a really humanistic environment. And then just to make the point that this happens even at a much larger scale, this is Tapiola Newtown in Finland, and this is where they're making a whole new town. And the decision was made at a certain point when Helsinki, the capital of Finland, was growing. Instead of just have urban sprawl around a single city center in Helsinki, instead we're going to make a satellite town, Tapiola, where we're going to have its own city center, its own downtown, and its own, so that everything will be more convenient. People aren't commuting in long distances to the center of Helsinki. Instead, we'll have another very convenient kind of town. That's a satellite town, and then occasionally you might come in for the symphony, or occasionally you might come into the train station to take a trip somewhere, or to the airport, but that your everyday life would be just as convenient as it was in the center of Helsinki, which is a modest-sized city. So when they're building this new town, there is the center of the town here, but then there are all these little neighborhoods, lots of little neighborhoods, and they're generally about, I don't know, 10, 15,000 people would live in a little neighborhood like that. And every neighborhood would have its own little neighborhood center where there would be shopping, schools, things like that, and residential areas around it. So it was, the whole town was planned from the beginning to be this very humanistic place. It was in a beautiful, beautiful natural environment. It's an archipelago right on the ocean. And beautiful forested area, so they kind of weave the city in there. It's got a tremendous range of people accommodated from day one. It's not going to be just one kind of person, but there are high-rise buildings, there are mid-rise buildings, there are apartments, there are single-family houses, there, and they're all kind of integrated together, not separated into siloed neighborhoods. There are tremendous amenities, lots of parks and recreation areas, and then in the center of town, big gyms and spas and recreation areas, And then immediately adjacent to that, often little townhouse neighborhoods or garden home neighborhoods that where you can easily walk to the center of the city and be involved in the life of the town. And then in each of those little neighborhood centers, this would be one of those areas where you've got shopping and you've got doctor's offices and services and things that would be there for that smaller neighborhood. Also in each of those neighborhoods, there are big recreation areas. You know, the weather's not great in the wintertime in Finland, but in the summertime, it's fantastic. And when you're there on a summer day, it's just packed with people jogging and playing tennis and playing soccer and all of those things in these parkways that run in between those neighborhoods in Tapiola. Tremendous variety of visual experience, all different kinds of buildings, many different architects involved in this over a period of about 15 years when they built out the city. And yet there is, it's all a very kind of modern city, and it's got a degree of harmony that's there as well. And everywhere, periodic natural relief. They maintain the forest, the greenery, the softness, the views, the connection to the ocean, so that you always feel like you're a part of nature as well. Now, it's interesting to me when we do these kinds of things in a city, people flock to it. It really makes a big difference. This is the San Antonio Riverwalk, the Paseo del Rio. It's a little piece of the city that for the past almost a century has been an amazing tourist attraction for San Antonio. This is now the largest tourist attraction in the state of Texas. More people go to the Riverwalk than go to the Alamo or go to the state capitol or any of those buildings. It has really been a great source of tourist industry for San Antonio. Tourism is now their largest industry in San Antonio. And a lot of it is because of the Riverwalk. They took this area that the San Antonio River bent like that, and in the 1920s and 30s, that was causing enormous flooding problems. As the water would come down the San Antonio River, it didn't want to make a turn like that, and it just would flood the whole downtown area right there. So there was a proposal to concrete in the San Antonio River so that it wouldn't flood. Dig it deeper and channelize it and make it able to accommodate those flood conditions. And that's what the Army Corps of Engineers was going to do. And there was a young architect in San Antonio, a guy named H.H. Hugman, who was actually a graduate from the School of Architecture here. He was in his 20s, and he said, that's going to be a terrible thing to put this big concrete ditch right through downtown San Antonio. What if you just made a little connection that let the river go this way and the floodwaters would go that way, but then the rest of the time when it wasn't flooding, the river would still be there in the banks that it is, and it could be a more stable body of water, and then it's kind of lower than the rest of the city, and you could have shops and restaurants and clubs and things down there, and you know, parks and gardens, and this could be a real beautiful area that would give great amenity to the city. So H.H. Hugman went around and solicited all the little garden clubs and the preservation clubs and other things like that, and little old ladies in tennis shoes in San Antonio, and they started a little political movement, and pretty soon they fought the Army Corps of Engineers, and they did get this completely different attitude toward the way the Riverwalk would be dealt with. And now there is a tremendous range of activities that are down there. There are shops and there are restaurants, and there's always a great parade and fiesta that goes along there. There's an amphitheater, there are events, there's music, there's now tons and tons of tourists everywhere. There are many signs of human presence. So they did a beautiful job of developing it initially. Wonderful little pieces of art and craft and commemoration, beautiful patterns of paving, exotic plants they brought in, plants that couldn't survive back, you know, in the normal upper part of the city. But because you have a slightly more stable temperature down lower there, they could bring in banana trees and they could bring in more tropical plants. They planted hundreds of varieties of these in the Riverwalk area, and made this incredible garden park active amenity for the city. And that then began to draw people in. Always, and especially in the original version, tremendous amount of periodic natural relief. They planted all these cypress trees. Those got to be huge, towering trees down there. And right in the middle of the city, there was this wonderful, lively oasis. Now, when you design with these kinds of principles, it gives that kind of economic benefit back to the city, this tourist industry. And in some ways, now the San Antonio Riverwalk is a victim of its own success. There are so many people down there, it's almost a little too crowded. And it's such a tourist draw that now sometimes people from San Antonio feel like it's all tourists that are down there. But now the whole Riverwalk notion has spread north and south. So now there's a whole Pearl Brewery thing around the San Antonio Museum of Art. So now they've extended the Riverwalk up and down the river, and it's become this more pervasive thing in many neighborhoods up and down the river in San Antonio. Tremendous gesture of humanism in the center of the city. Similar kind of thing has been going on the last few years in Chicago. They took an old rail yard and turned it into Millennium Park. The same kinds of activities that we're seeing in San Antonio Riverwalk. Just lots of places for people to hang out, be a part of a community. Tremendous range of people accommodated, little kids. It's my kind of low-income neighborhood, so a lot of kids from that neighborhood come in. But then people also from the businesses and offices have their lunch down there. Great variety of people having fun and enjoying themselves there. My favorite part of Millennium Park is what's called Crown Fountain. It's an art installment, actually. It has these two towers that have lit from behind big faces, and they have faces of people in Chicago, just random people the artist took photographs of. And these faces are slowly, it's a video, so they're blinking their eyes, or they're smiling, or they're making gestures with their faces. And then at a certain point, those faces kind of purse their lips and push them together. And then, voila, water spews out of their mouth. And so all of the little kids in the plaza, which is this kind of plaza that's flooded with water just a couple inches deep, just kind of fun, splashy place. And the water's coming out there, and the kids all line up because they know that's going to spew out for a little while. And they all very politely give each other a turn to go through that water. And then they also kind of know the sequence of the fountain, and then they line up to get spewed on, and then they line up against the back of the fountain there because they know that then the water is going to come crashing down and splash them in a completely different way. There's this whole kind of urban orchestration and event that goes on there with Crown Fountain. But again, it's one of these things that brings people together, that makes events and action and lively accommodation of activity there. Okay, Twitter card question for today. 10 years from now, when you're deciding where you want to live, what city you want to live in, what neighborhood you want to live in, I want to know how important these issues are going to be to you. So on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 is, this is super important. I want to live in a city or a neighborhood that is addressing these issues. Number 1 is super important. Number 10 is, I don't freaking care. These things don't matter to me at all. Maybe it's all about my house. I don't even care about my neighborhood or my community. Completely honest and frank, give me a number. Where do you sit on a scale of 1 to 10? And tell me a little bit why this would be important to you, or why it would not be important to you.